Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. Today we're looking at our relationship with one of our most important and emerging Indo-Pacific neighbours, India. We'll be discussing this important issue with one of Australia's foremost experts, University of Queensland Chancellor Peter Varghese. He's the author of The India Economic Strategy and a former Director General of the Office of National Assessments, a senior advisor to the Prime Minister, High Commissioner to Malaysia and India, and former Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Hello, my name's Ron Candelars. I'm a freelance journalist and producer. And throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. With me in the studio is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight universities, who's recently returned from India. Well, firstly, Peter Varghese, thank you very much for joining us today. Let's start with Australia's place in the current geopolitical environment. Are we truly embedded as a key player and influencer in Asia, do you think?
Well, I think it's going to be a long process as to how things work out in Asia and therefore the extent of our embedment and influence wielding, I think, is going to be an unfolding story because I think at the moment we're somewhere between a tipping point and a settling point when it comes to both the strategic and the economic trajectory of the region, whether you call it the Indo-Pacific or some other more truncated version. We've passed a tipping point in the sense that the old order, the so-called liberal international order, the rules-based order, fundamentally a US-led system, I think has now effectively disappeared. It's going to take us a long time to work out what replaces it. In other words, to work out where the settling point is and how Australia navigates those challenges. And I think this is going to be a decades-long process, will ultimately determine the extent of our influence. I mean, we're embedded to this extent, Ron, and that is that we have a seat at most of the high tables. And that has always been a great objective of Australian diplomacy, to be able to have a say where it most matters. So whether you're looking at relatively new constructs like the Quad, or whether you're looking at what now seems to be more frequent invitations to the Group of Seven or to NATO, or whether you look at our membership of regional institutions, although they're not as strong as they were, say, 5 or 6 years ago, I think Australia does have a voice. And the question is how we project that voice and what we choose to say with it.
Do you think when you talk about, you use the word project, does the military and strategic heft of something like AUKUS, with all the backing of the United Kingdom and America that comes with it, do you think that increases our heft in the region as well, or does it make some of our near neighbours nervous?
Well, I think heft is a combination of a number of things. I mean, obviously, your economic strength is a key component of your heft. But I think your defence strategic capability is also a very important component. And to the extent that AUKUS, and, you know, AUKUS is a long way away from delivering heft. At the moment, it's a plan, but not a delivered product. But to the extent that AUKUS will give us this new capability, if it works according to plan in terms of nuclear-powered submarines, I think does add to Australia's defence capability. And we have always, I think, in the region, been seen as a country which has a significant and credible strategic reach. And I can only see that growing rather than diminishing.
I've just come back from the UK and Europe, and we had travelling with us a really heavy defence component. And we also had the former Chief of Defence, Angus Houston, co-author of the Defence Strategic Review, travelling with us. And certainly from the universities, from the perspective of the universities, that second pillar of AUKUS will be really significant if it comes to being in terms of building capability across those streams. And I also kind of really felt that just observing the reaction from people that we met with, so defence in Berlin, defence in Sweden, you know, sort of the European, and also with Stephen Smith, High Commissioner to the UK, but the co-author of that report, that Pillar 2 in many ways is as important, if not more, in terms of the development of our capability building in the region, but also in terms of, if using that your word, heft, in terms of how we kind of work with the US and the UK. And there's also at the moment a whole lot of things going on. Of course, we've had Osmin at the weekend in Brisbane. So where do you see AUKUS Pillar 2, Peter?
I think it's going to be a very important part of the overall AUKUS arrangements, because technology and defence capability historically have always been closely related. But clearly we're entering into a period of intense technological change, and whether it's artificial intelligence or quantum computing or unmanned capability, I mean, you get the sense that we're on the threshold of some major technological breakthroughs which will undoubtedly have a military application. So I think to the extent that AUKUS represents Australia cooperating with technology leaders like the United States, and the United Kingdom is in a slightly different league, but nevertheless has very significant capabilities, I mean, I think that will have a big impact on the way in which we're able to develop our capabilities. And clearly the universities are going to play a very important role in that, because we're at the forefront of research and technology.
Which brings me to the technological aspect. Obviously has a huge bearing on the economy and trade more generally. And the India Economic Strategy is this report into how we should be doing business with our close neighbour India, fastest growing economy in the world. Do you think both governments are taking it really seriously? And do you think there's been a change in attitude, particularly with the Albanese government?
I think both governments are definitely taking it seriously. I mean, if you look at the bilateral relationship now, measured in terms of the government-to-government relationship, it's clearly in a very sweet spot and as close as it's ever been. I mean, look, I think this is largely a bipartisan position on the part of Australia. I think the previous government was also very focused on India. I mean, my report, the India Economic Strategy, was commissioned by the Turnbull government, and I think the Albanese government has taken it forward with a great deal of vigour and energy. And of course, both the geopolitical and the geoeconomic environment in which our relationship is developing is changing quite rapidly, and in a way which makes India in many ways an even more significant potential partner for Australia than it might have been 5 years ago when I wrote that report, because we are now facing the prospect of a global economy which is more decoupled than we've been used to. We're finding that a lot of the fundamental pillars of international economic cooperation are now struggling to get traction from a political perspective. So we're seeing a new protectionism. We've seen a much bigger role for industry policy. We've seen, in my view, an over-interpretation of the meaning of self-reliance post-COVID, and we're seeing a slowing of globalization. So if you take all of that together with the fault line between the US and China looking as if it's going to get deeper rather than shallower, then India is going to be a big part of how all of this plays out. Its geostrategic positioning is going to be important. Its ability to contribute to a new balance, a new strategic equilibrium is going to be important. And of course, it will have a strong economic role to play. I mean, it will be, in the next 4 or 5 years, the third largest economy in the world measured by market exchange rates, already that in purchasing power parity. there'll still be an enormous gap, in my view, between the US and China on the one hand and India on the other. But, you know, when the third or fifth largest economy in the world, depending how you measure it, also happens to be the fastest growing economy in the world, that is going to represent a very significant opportunity, but it will also have a very significant impact on the dynamic of the region.
Just go back to the interpretation of the over-reliance on that sovereign capability. Just tease that out a bit more for me.
Well, I think psychologically, COVID made us particularly sensitive to our vulnerability on global supply chains. And that is translated into a greater focus on self-reliance, which has enormous political appeal, I think, across the world. I'm not just talking about Australia. I mean, I think in some ways, Australia has moved less along this path than some others. Now, the fear I have is that we overcompensate in that direction, and that, you know, concepts such as comparative advantage are somehow considered to be irrelevant to the future structure of global economic relations, or indeed to Australia's positioning globally. I mean, at the end of the day, the laws of economic gravity don't change, even through something as convulsive as COVID. And we know how the story ends. I mean, the more countries turn inwards, the more we restrict our trading reach, the more we narrow our investment options, we suffer from falling living standards. I mean, this is the story of the period between the First and the Second World War. So I think we are at some risk of throwing the baby out with the bathwater here, and I hope that we can find a recalibration and a better understanding of what shouldn't change, as opposed to, you know, what we convince ourselves needs to be changed.
And do you think, Peter, that going back to Ron's very first question really around AUKUS, do you think the putting aside the actual sort of the what may all come out of AUKUS, but does that agreement actually send particular signals to the region about where we are putting our focus in terms of building our capability, whether it's sovereign or not, in those areas we talked about with our major partners? Is it sending a message into the region that they would be uncomfortable with? Because I've certainly spoken to others, eminent thinkers and scholars, who do say that in the region, AUKUS is not viewed very favourably, and it's like Australia is ignoring us as a result.
Yeah, so look, I think the reaction in the region is mixed. Some parts of the region, I think, are entirely comfortable with AUKUS. Japan, for example, India, Singapore. But there would be some countries in Southeast Asia who worry that AUKUS will deepen a US-China fault line in a way that they are uncomfortable with. And I think particularly in Southeast Asia, which just does not want to have to make a choice between the US and China, any arrangement which looks like it's heading in the direction of a sharp geostrategic division is going to bring with it a level of uncomfort in Southeast Asia. And so, you know, AUKUS has, I think, those challenges to deal with. But overall, my sense is that we've had a measure of success in explaining what AUKUS is and why, for instance, it ought not to represent a non-proliferation concern, because that was also something that was raised very early on in the AUKUS announcement. And I think there's also an understanding, even if it's not often publicly stated in Southeast Asia, that the concept of a equilibrium or a balance is fundamentally stabilizing. In other words, while no country in Southeast Asia, in my view, wants to be put in the position where they have to make a stark choice between the US and China, most of them recognize that a stable equilibrium is ultimately the only long-term solution for managing what are in some ways irreconcilable strategic objectives between the United States and China. And in terms of where we fit into all of that, well, look, I don't think it comes as any surprise to anyone in the region that Australia is a close ally of the United States. And I don't think it will come as any surprise if a stark choice has to be made, and I don't think we've quite got there yet, and hopefully we won't get to the point of a very stark choice, but I don't think there'd be any surprise as to where we'd end up in that position.
Which then brings us to the changing nature of alliances within the Indo-Pacific and brings us back to India again. In your report, you say business has long put India in the too hard basket, and there are three overriding reasons why this must change: scale, complementary economies, and spreading risk. Can you speak to that?
So, well, scale in a sense is obvious. I mean, and we've talked about the size of the Indian economy, and that's only going to get bigger. So India as a market, India as an economic player, India as a country that will want to exert a level of influence, you know, consistent with its weight, is only going to get more important. I think complementarity is what I tried to go most deeply into in my report, which is the fact that the Indian economy is going to need a number of things that the Australian economy is well placed to provide. And so there is a structural complementarity between Australia and India, which I think is a pretty solid basis for building an economic relationship. And spreading risk or diversification, I mean, I wrote that 5 years ago. If anything, that argument has become a lot stronger as we see the slowing of globalization, as we see, whether you call it decoupling or de-risking, for all of those reasons, and it goes back to our earlier discussion about supply chains and so on, India is on everyone's diversification list. I mean, any country pursuing a China plus strategy has India on the list. And India itself now, I think, is trying to position itself to take advantage of some of these broader geopolitical and geoeconomic trends by itself becoming a more important player in global supply chains.
So you say that Australia should set itself the goal by 2035 to lift India into its top three export markets and to make it the third largest destination in Asia for Australian outward investment. That's a big shift over the next 10 or so years.
It is a big shift, but bear in mind that the Indian economy itself will be growing over that period, and therefore the opportunities that it presents will also be elevated. I think that remains an ambitious set of targets, but I think it's also a set of targets that can be achieved. Where I think we're probably dragging our feet most is in outward investment. I don't think the investment trends between Australia and India are strong enough. Certainly they need to be stronger to get us to where we want to get. And it's been the story of Australia's economic engagement with Asia that it's trade intensive and investment light, with some exceptions such as Japan and Singapore in a more complicated way. We need to bring trade and investment much more into balance, and we need to recognize that there are enormous synergies between outward investment and trade returns. And I see that being a much more important part of our economic relationship with India, not least because India itself, in my opinion, is much more open to foreign investment than it is to trade liberalisation. Mm. I mean, India's political culture is fundamentally still quite protectionist, but there is an openness to foreign investment, which I think will be crucial to India's own economic development and also very important in the way in which we build our own bilateral economic relationship.
What do you think that reticence has been there on the Australian side?
Well, in the case of investment, I think investment is sort of a shorthand measure of level of comfort. I mean, it's no accident that Australia's big outward investment destinations are Europe and North America, because I think Australian business has a level of comfort in dealing with those systems. They understand them. They think they know them pretty well. They have a rule of law which you know, gives them a level of comfort. I think an Asian environment, and notwithstanding the fact that India has many common institutional arrangements, you know, compared with Australia. I still think when Australian business looks to invest overseas, that lack of familiarity, that lack of deep knowledge, that level of may not be discomfort, but it is not knowing the place enough to give you comfort still plays a big role. And that's why, you know, this broader question of Asia literacy, Asia capability becomes so important. And I think, you know, we need to be doing a much better job of inculcating that from a very early stage in our education system, so that people have, I think, the sort of level of comfort in engaging with Asia that we need for our national future.
And of course, universities have a significant role to play in that, both in terms of international student engagement and international research. And we've talked about that previously. And of course, in your economic strategy, you had education as one of the key pillars. And I think we're starting to see that, as you say, in just 5 years, a lot has changed in terms of that push for diversification. But I just wanted to take you back, if I can, still on the international engagement piece, but wearing your Chancellor hat. In 2019, you warned that universities were locking themselves into a funding model that relies on growing international student enrolments and could fundamentally change the character of Australian universities. And of course, you're the Chancellor of one of our Group of Eight universities. One in three international students are at a Group of Eight university. A significant proportion of those are from China. We have very small numbers of students across the Group of Eight from India, around 11,000. So, you know, that's quite small for us. Has the horse already bolted? Are we already fundamentally changed when you look back at that comment and where we are now, just a few short years later?
Well, Vicky, I think there are two elements to this. And the first element is one that gets a lot of attention, which is really our risk exposure to a single market. And I think all universities are trying to deal with that. I expect our ability to fundamentally shift that reliance quickly is going to be quite limited, because ultimately we're operating in a market, and a market is driven by supply and demand. And to the extent that demand from China remains high, I don't see Australian universities declining Chinese enrolments on the basis that they're pursuing a diversification strategy. But that said, I think we need to be doing as much as we can to encourage a more diverse mix of international students. And I think we should do things such as setting up, as we have at the University of Queensland, a future fund which can bank some of the revenue from international students to enable us to deal with, you know, out of the blue developments that can affect our financial sustainability. The second element of this, which I don't think, frankly, gets enough attention in Australia, is what does all of this mean for the character of Australian universities as public institutions with a primary obligation to educate the next generation of Australian students? Because if you leave this just to a market, we will see the proportion of international to domestic students increasing steadily. And the question I would pose is, at what point do you then cease to be an Australian public institution? And personally, I think it's very important that universities retain that character. And I would have thought Australian taxpayers might also have a view on whether or not they should retain that character. I would like to see us have a much more substantial discussion on that question, and whether there are ways in which we can continue to reap the benefits, both financial and soft power benefits, from international students while still fundamentally remaining an Australian public institution. And that goes in part to the proportions between international and domestic, but it also goes very much to the question of the experience of international students and wanting to ensure that their interaction with domestic students and indeed with the Australian community is, you know, as healthy and as easy as we can make it. And I think we need to think very carefully about whether that's
Can I just take you back to that, the Future Fund, and I'm I know the University of Queensland has been kind of ahead of the game, and you've done that, I think, haven't you, at the University of Queensland. Of course, the University Accord, and we are speaking to Mary O'Kane shortly, but the University Accord, which was released by the federal government, or the interim report rather, just I think in the last couple of weeks, proposes consideration of a levy on international student fee income as a mechanism to provide insurance against future economic policy or other shocks. And I noted, I think it was the University of Illinois, I think it was, they actually took out insurance on a proportion of their international fee income to guard against, you know, a downturn. That's slightly different. That's a tax on universities which have been very successful in terms of student recruitment, going into a pot to fund national and sector priorities, the report says, such as infrastructure and research. So in my mind, that simply reinforces the distorted funding model we've had, where we've ripped the Band-Aid off and we've admitted that actually international student fee income is supporting our research. So now let's put a tax on that income and let's just redistribute that. And I'd just be interested in your views on that particular part of the accord, given your proposal for the Future Fund earlier.
Sure. I mean, I think it was a very broad reference without too much detail going into it. So I'm not sure what the authors of that think a tax on international students, how it would be structured, what purpose it would go to, how it would be levied. But look, I think the point you're making is a good point. It fundamentally deepens the challenge we've got rather than resolves the challenge that we've got. Look, there are various ways in which you can manage financial risk. And I think, you know, universities are not blasé about that. But at the end of the day, we have to come to grips with the sort of reality that our future as a nation is going to be, to a very large extent, determined by our capacity to innovate. And our capacity to innovate in turn is going to be greatly influenced by the performance of our universities. So I don't think we can subcontract the investment in research to international students, which is essentially what a tax on international students would be and would certainly appear to be.
Well, it's essentially what we're doing now, frankly.
Well, it is. So it is in terms of research, and that's why I would argue that indeed we need to find a way to continue to be top performing on research without having the funding for that dependent on our ability to recruit international students. I mean, that's going to be a part of it, but it shouldn't be the basic game plan. That's where we are.
But has that horse bolted? And it seems that, you know, when you look at universities, they rely so heavily on the money from international students. And to go to your point, it does then undermine the notion of an Australian university offering valued courses for Australian students. It seems to be, you know, diametrically opposed.
Yeah, I'm not sure the horse has bolted, but I think we need to find ways of making sure that the horse remains on the right race course. if I could continue the analogy. See, I don't worry much about supply and demand with international students, because even if the China market were to look very different very quickly, if you look out at the region, the gap between what regional countries need and what they can offer domestically is huge. And it's not going to be easily bridged. So they will always, in my view, be very high demand for an Australian university education. It's how we think about where that fits into our overall education settings, particularly when it comes to research, where the policy challenges lie. And, you know, I hope we can end up with a framework which is better than what we currently have.
Just coming back to India again, then, one of the things, I went on the website and I looked at a particular example of almond growers here in Australia looking at the potential for exports to India, and getting back to the options, the opportunities that India provides, they do seem staggering, and they're obviously staggering in terms of trade, but also in terms of increasing the number of Indian students at our universities as well, and having relationships between the two countries based on research that benefits both countries in the long term.
Well, look, I mean, the reason I put education as the sort of flagship of the future Australia-India relationship is because I think the skills deficit in India is, one, huge, but two, fundamental to its future economic success. In other words, bridging that skills deficit is fundamental to its future economic success. And it's ideally tailored for an Australia-India partnership because I think we have something to offer India when it comes to education. And here I'm thinking not just of higher education, but I'm thinking particularly of vocational education, which in many ways is the more urgent requirement for India than higher education is. So if you take all of that together, plus the capacity for us to develop a deep research partnership, because India is not strong on research. I mean, it's got pockets of research excellence, but overall, India is not strong on research. And again, you know, I think going back to my argument about complementarity, that's a real opportunity for Australia. And, you know, we at the University of Queensland have set up a joint research academy with Delhi IIT. It's designed to run a joint PhD program. We already have over 100 enrolments in that. I mean, these are the sorts of things that we should be doing in the education relationship. The numbers of Indian students coming to Australia, in a sense, will look after themselves. We need to make sure that we're addressing the sort of deep research collaboration and not just focusing on recruitment of student numbers. Mm.
Peter Varghese, there's plenty to consider in the years ahead, but thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Ron, and thanks, Vicky. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you. Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to the debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.